Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm John. This is the Think Inclusive podcast.
Recording from my office in beautiful Marietta, Georgia, you are listening to the Think Inclusive podcast, episode 16. Today we have John Spencer, speaker and author of Empower and Launch, entertaining and practical books that help us to rethink how we deliver content and engage students in the learning process. We talk about what it looks like to help students own their learning, including students with disabilities. After the podcast, please stop by our Patreon page where you can support our goal to bring you in-depth interviews with inclusive education and community advocacy thought leaders. In order to cover our hosting, transcription, and production costs, we need to meet our goal of $100 per month. Please help us keep this vital resource available to everyone by pledging your support of $1, $5, $10, or $20 per month. When you pledge as little as $1 per month, you get access to our patron-only feed for blog posts, special edition podcasts, and picture updates along the way. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Physical Attraction, the podcast that tries to explain physics one pickup line at a time. From the laws of nature to the end of the world, you can find the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, and on Twitter at PhysicsPod. So without further ado, here is the interview. I'd like to welcome John Spencer to the Think Inclusive podcast. John is a professor and author in Oregon. He is the author of Empower and Launch, which is part of what we're going to talk about today. And also, he is passionate about seeing every child embrace a maker mindset. Thank you for being on the Think Inclusive podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. Okay, so number one, I don't know a whole lot about you other than I think we have mutual friends, right, from way back when. And you lived in Arizona, which is what we talked about before we started recording. So how long have you been an educator?
So I started, this would have been like maybe 14 years ago. I started teaching middle school.
Okay.
I had worked for an inner city faith-based nonprofit. And from there, I decided, you know, I really want to be a teacher in the same community. And so I taught middle school for 12 years. And then now for the last 2 years, I've been teaching at the university level.
Fantastic. And so your middle school experience, then that's interesting that you have it, that you stayed with middle school. Is that what, I guess, what drew you to middle school age students?
You know, I think for me, there were a lot of things about middle school that were significant. I think, you know, I had my best teacher was in the eighth grade. You know, she was a teacher who, you know, for the first time ever, I got to to truly own learning in her class. And I did a year-long project. It was this really cool History Day project. And, you know, I think it had a huge impact on my life. You know, I think that particular year was interesting for other reasons, you know, difficult for other reasons. That year I had a friend in the eighth grade who committed suicide. And so it was a really emotional year as well. And so I think, you know, when I majored in education, I really thought I would be in high school. And then I did student teaching in the middle school and thought, you know what, this is where I belong. This is what I love doing. And I just kind of ended up in there. Like, I really thought I would be a high school teacher. But from the first day I started student teaching in middle school, I kind of realized this is my place.
So after working so many years in middle school, I guess what helped you make the transition to teaching at the university level?
Yeah, I think for me, the ease of the transition was that I had done a lot of, you know, professional development for teachers. I've done, you know, conferences and keynotes and things like that. Workshops, a lot of professional development at my district. So I was really comfortable working with current teachers, new teachers, pre-service teachers, that kind of stuff. So it's kind of an easy transition there. And I think I was just ready for something different. You know, I had loved teaching middle school, but I was ready to, I just started to I guess, develop a passion for helping pre-service teachers become, you know, teachers and reach their potential.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about your book. So Launch, which was written a couple years ago, is that right? Or is it more recent than that?
Yeah, it was just over, about a year and a half ago.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And could you tell me, because I read Empower, but I did not read Launch. So maybe you could tell me and our listeners what Launch is about.
Yeah, so Launch is basically about the design thinking process. And, you know, there's a lot of different frameworks out there, but A.J. Giuliani and I had developed kind of a K-12 one. And so the gist of it is it's an acronym, and I know people hate acronyms, but it's an acronym. So it stands for Launch. The L stands for Look, Listen, and Learn, and that's kind of where you start with awareness. It could be, you know, awareness of a problem. It could be awareness of a social issue. It could be empathy that you have toward an audience. And then from there, you kind of move into inquiry, and that's the A, and that's ask tons of questions. Then the U is understand the process or problem, and that's when kids are engaged in some kind of research. And it could be you know, interviews, needs assessments, it could be online research, it could be books, whatever. And then they begin to ideate and plan and kind of brainstorm, and that's the navigate ideas, so that's the N of the Launch. And then a big portion of it is C, which is create a prototype. So they're creating something that they're going to actively iterate and improve and change. And that's the next piece, H, which is where they highlight what's working and fix what's failing. And then when that's finished, they launch it to an audience. And that last piece is really significant. I think it's important that students, you know, share their work with, you know, an authentic audience.
So I'm assuming that this was something that you developed while you were in middle school and teaching middle school students. And
yes.
So I want to kind of bring it that idea of the design process, and then also, you know, when we talk about Empower, about mm-hmm. students and you're the design thinking can be applicable for all students, including students with special needs or students with disabilities, however you want to say it. And I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about how you can still do this type of design thinking with students with disabilities.
Yeah, absolutely. So, first of all, it really is like any subject. So, I taught self-contained, so I taught all subjects. And, it fits every subject, and it fits every type of learner. And you will have to provide supports still, and that piece is important. So, when I taught self-contained, I had the students who were ELL, and I had students who were gifted, and then I had a good portion in the class who were classified as special ed. And so basically I had nobody in my class didn't have some kind of a label attached to it, right? They all needed different types of support. So it is important that accommodations are still happening and things like that. But what I'll say is, I definitely think it works with students who, qualify as special ed, or like you said, whatever terminology you want to use, special needs. There's a lot of great examples of that. So, I had students who were labeled as nonverbal autistic, and they thrived in the design process. When we did things like the design a roller coaster project or building a city, these were some moments where they really, really shined. It was powerful to see them share their work with the world. So I give the example of we use the design process for student blogging, and I had a student who didn't really say anything at all, and who really struggled with certain areas of articulation. But by going through this process and having the time to iterate and improve and revise, it was really cool to watch him develop this video game blog, and it was so cool to watch the power of the launch, where he was sharing his work with the world, and in this case, he published it on a blogging platform. And I still remember the day where it was just maybe the second week of school, and he wasn't, because he was nonverbal, there weren't a lot of conversations, and he kind of had in many ways been excluded, as much as I was trying to create an inclusive community. It was early on in the year, and I was still trying to figure out how to make this work. And I still remember, suddenly there's 10 comments on his blog, and so many kids are into his blog. And I remember, just the power of for him to have an audience was really cool. So I don't know if I answered your question. I just think that the process can be applicable to all students, I guess is what I would say.
Yeah, I think one of the things is you actually have to believe that all students can do this. So I think one of the barriers is that when you think about project-based learning or design thinking, or I don't know how to say all that stuff, but students who are nonverbal, who have limited speech, who have particular disabilities, they're just not even thought of in the process of that they would even get anything out of it. Number one for an educator to be like, well, of course they're going to be included in this, and we are going to, however they are able to access the curriculum or access, letting us know what they prefer or choose is the way that we can get them to, buy into their own learning. I think that's like number one, really, is mm-hmm. actually believing that our students can do this, no matter who they are, what label they have. So, So that's, I mean, I'm just excited to hear that that's something that was even on your mind.
Well, and I want to point something else out. Like, you know, one of the valuable things in the Navigate Ideas phase, they have to engage in project management. And so there's a big metacognition piece and there's a big, project planning piece. And, because of the need for accommodations, I had several students who, had issues with, executive function. And so the strategies of helping them through executive function, in project planning turned out to be strategies that every student benefited from. And it's a little bit like, you know, it's the whole idea that universal access isn't just for people with a label. Universal access helps everyone. It's the same kind of idea. Every student benefited from the structured aspect of learning how to plan or learning how to break down tasks. Or does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Why don't we talk a little bit about what that looks like? And I know that you talk about it in Empower, mm-hmm. about, you know, what it actually looks like in the classroom for this to happen. Maybe the fear of that you're losing control of the classroom, that there's mm-hmm. going to be too many people doing too many different things, that, you know, it's going to be too loud. It's there's all of these different, I guess, perceived yeah. barriers to doing something like this, including like, well, I, you know, John, I've got a curriculum that I need to teach. You know, I have standards that I need to teach. When am I yeah. going to have time to do this? You know, mm-hmm. so maybe you can address some of those fears or concerns.
Oh, definitely. So, you know, I think I'll just give the example of, what am I going to do with having so many kids doing so many different things at the same time? And I think, you know, that piece is significant in terms of, you already have kids doing so many different things at the same time. Like if you're teaching one lesson and assuming that you're teaching it to all kids, there's a whole group of your classroom that's already off task doing something different. So like already that's already happening, that some of them are not doing the same thing as others. They're already not working at the same pace. We know that in every lesson that we teach. And so, you know, the question is, you know, what happens if they are doing something different that's productive? You know, what happens if they're doing something that is actually connected to their learning? And it is tough. You do have to let go of a little bit of control as a teacher. But if there's high motivation, then, you know, you end up with higher engagement. I realize that it's not always going to work perfectly, but I think it's important to remember ahead of time that it's not working perfectly already. The status quo is not, in many cases, not working. But with that said, some of the big questions, the curriculum app question or the time question or even the assessment question that comes up all the time, I think those really come down to the idea that design thinking or empowering your students, kind of either of those two ideas, they're not about adding something new to your plate. It's about a different way of organizing your plate, right? It's about structuring your classroom in a different way. And it is a little bit rocky at first. Like I can't promise it's going to work perfectly. I can't promise it's always going to be this utopia. But when the engagement goes up and students are empowered, when they own their learning, that kind of stuff happens, you know, you do find that that it works. I mean, that's in terms of how it actually works, I think there are some strategies that we know can help out. So if you take the curriculum map example, you know, the curriculum map tells you everything you have to learn at a given time, right? So you have to teach this standard on this day, this standard on that day. But it doesn't tell you what you can't teach. And so if you have all students hitting one particular standard, but you're empowering all of your students to hit other different types of standards, you're not breaking with the curriculum map. You're just, teaching to all of your students. And sometimes you have to kind of use the language that the principals use, or the leaders. So I always said, if we did a design thinking process, and it was in language arts, I'll give that as an example. I was making sure that the standard and objective on the board fit the curriculum map, and they were in my lesson plans, but we're also hitting several other standards that are significant. And if a principal asked me, why are you doing these standards? I could say, well, we're just spiraling back to standards, or those are review standards. Or if a principal said, why do you have 10 kids who are all learning different objectives right now? I would say, this is embedded intervention and enrichment. And those types of things were really helpful. I don't know if I answered your question. Is this such a big question?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is a big question.
Yeah.
And I don't think, I don't think there is one particular answer as far as, how you're going to do that. I think the biggest thing is that you have to be creative. As the teacher, you have to be creative and say, how am I going to make this work and be committed to it, making it work. And I think it's an empower, that you talk about, if this is kind of a new concept or you just want to kind of put your toe into the water a little bit, to try out just one project with this thinking. And one of the best ways to do it, and I think this is brilliant, is to do it during kind of the lame duck season, which would be like testing. like you have, your whole morning shot because you're doing the state test, but you have all afternoon. And rather than just kind of plodding along like you normally would, use that as a way to introduce this project, so you can really keep the
eye. Or the week before winter break.
Right.
Those types of things.
Right.
For
right.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Thank you.
In fact, I think I even tried that with my class last year. I'm no longer a classroom teacher. I'm more of a consultant now with my district. But when I did have my classroom, we did audio interviews towards the end of the year. Where we would interview each other, and that was a really fun, example of just something different. We are not writing a story. We're not, not everyone's doing the same thing, but everyone's getting access to something a little bit different. So that was really fun. And I encourage teachers to, take those times where you're like, we don't have enough time to really go through the rest of this particular curriculum. So let's, mix it up a little bit. So I want to talk about this idea of compliance in education, which was in the foreword in Empower. And it really struck me that, compliance should not be the end goal of education, and and it kind of goes to this idea that the classroom should be well organized and ordered and just so, and students are doing exactly what the teacher is telling them to do. If there's any deviation, then the class is out of control. And, it reflects against the teacher, I wanted to know if you would talk about that a little bit and I guess give me your, take on why compliance isn't enough.
Yeah. So I kind of view it as like this was in the, you're right, it was in the foreword. I put together kind of this, the spectrum of and you start out at one side where students have no real agency at all. They're just following the rules, and that's compliance. And then they move into a place of engagement where they have some agency, but it's still about what the teacher wants, right? So they're following the teacher, but at least things are interesting to them, right? But then when you move out of just student interest into like true ownership, then you're in that place where students are empowered. And I think it's significant for a couple different reasons. Like, I go to the heart of what we want from our kids, right? So you know, I'm a dad, we've got three kids. I know a lot of parents. And if you ask parents, you know, what do you want for your kid in life? They'll say, I want my kid to be a lifelong learner. I want my kid to be successful in a job. I want my kid to be a critical thinking, democratic citizen, right? Like those are the types of answers you get. And none of those answers ever include compliance. Like if you're a really great democratic, critical thinking citizen who's engaged with your world, then compliance is not your goal. If you are going to enter the creative economy and think like an entrepreneur and be different and push the envelope and be innovative, then you're probably not going to be aiming for compliance. You know, if you're going to be a lifelong learner who pursues your interests and passions and studies things on your own, then you're probably not going to be compliant because that would mean you're waiting to be told what to do. So I kind of think like compliance is really in many ways the opposite of what we want from kids, what we truly want them to become as they grow up.
Right. So I guess as a follow-up question about compliance, did you see, I guess, the behavior of your students change when you implement this design thinking, like behavior as in, you know, difficult or challenging behavior?
Yeah. So I would say this, like the worst behaviors that I had in the class, or the those times that were cringeworthy as a teacher, those moments where I, you know, shamed a kid or I yelled at the class, those were always times where I was demanding compliance and I was trying to get students to follow me for the sake of following me rather than thinking about how to help them become self-directed and self-regulated and whatnot. They were also always the times when we were doing an assignment that was totally teacher-directed, right? So they were the worst moments of teaching, but they were also very compliance driven. On the other hand, you know, when students were designing things or when they were even doing choice driven silent reading or when they were doing blogging or whatever, so not just design thinking but in general just the other types of things that we were doing, where they felt empowered, you know, there weren't a lot of discipline issues. I'm not saying it was perfect, that there were still moments where kids would get upset or emotional, frustrated. You still had groups where, you know, kids would have conflict with each other, but it was so much easier in those moments to handle it as a learning opportunity. Whereas when it was in the midst of compliance, it was almost always, you know, you jump to this overbearing, you know, discipline style. And so I really think, like, when students are truly empowered, behavior is less of an issue. And I know there are students on behavior plans. I'm not pretending that things are perfect. I think of those groups I had, that I mentioned before, you know, when I taught self-contained or later when I taught an elective, I had students who, you know, were labeled as ED, who, like I said, were on behavior plans and things weren't perfect. You know, you never knew completely what might cause a student to, struggle and lose control and whatever. But I can tell you that the sense of control they felt, the sense of agency that they felt in owning their learning actually, like, allowed them to thrive a lot more than when they were in a compliance-driven environment.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. I'd love to hear more stories about that, especially from, you know, other educators too, who have tried to implement, you know, the project-based learning design thinking. And I know in my own experience, giving students choice and allowing them to follow their passions and interests really does help with engagement, but it also does help with behavior, because if you have obsessive interests in your class, or, you know, they're following through with that, they're less likely to really think or do anything else except that. So
exactly. I mean, I had in my STEM class, I remember, so in the last couple of years I taught STEM and photojournalism. This is after I taught the self-contained group. And, you know, we had students who had the biggest behavioral needs were in our school. And they all were kind of in their own self-contained classroom. And then the only class they got to be mainstreamed into was their elective. And that meant I had them for STEM as a group. And I remember, you know, hearing people are going to throw chairs and there's going to be this and there's going to be that. And you have some runners, so just be cognizant of that. And it can be a special walkie-talkie. And the truth is, I didn't see those behaviors. I did have moments where, you know, there was a moment where a kid got upset with me. Not upset with me. He was upset because he was working on something he cared about, and he was frustrated, and he threw his folder down onto the table and was angry, you know. But they all, you know, despite that one moment, I didn't have the big, I didn't have the throwing of chairs. I didn't have the, I didn't have any violent things happening, to be honest. And it was just, I think it's because they genuinely wanted to be there. Like they really found the class to be engaging. And it was very choice driven. And I bring that up because I was warned ahead of time that, yeah, I was told specifically, I know you believe in student choice, but don't give them choice. They'll take advantage of you. I mean, those were the words from a specialist. And that just wasn't my experience. I really believe in the idea that when we say all means all, we really mean it. Like, and that includes choice. That includes, student ownership. I really believe that every kid deserves access to that.
Right. Right. I love that you had that experience, because, because that is a common thing that is said about students, you know, who are struggling with, you know, with their behaviors, is don't give in. They're being manipulative. Don't give them an inch, because if you give them an inch, they're gonna, you know, walk all over you, and then they're, you know, you're not gonna have control. You know, and so It's really nice to hear you say that because I think it's easy for people on in the special education field to think that when they do give choice or even grace, right, for certain behaviors that they're giving in or that they're letting themselves, be walked over. But I think it's a mindset, right? You are not giving away anything except acceptance of who these students are. So you are believing in the students' best selves when you are
Yes,
giving
exactly.
them choice and saying, how do you want to direct this? Like, where do you want to go with this? And to hear that students are able to make that choice and be successful with it, I would think that that's, empowering.
Yeah.
So yeah, I love that. I don't want to take up too much of your time, so I want maybe we'll have one more question. And I see you as a person that has a lot of vision, especially vision for just education in general. So where would you like to see education in the next 10 to 20 years?
I love that question.
That's a big question, but
Oh man, I think I'd love to see education become more project-based, more authentic. I'd love to see it become more connective, kind of breaking up the subjects and having things be interdisciplinary. I'd love to see us do away with tracking. I'd love to see multiple abilities, multiple grade levels even working together. I think that's what I would love to see. Yeah, I am, but really focused on creativity. I'd love to see kids making and designing and building and having a lot more choice in what they're doing.
What do you think it would take to really for that to become a reality?
So I think one thing is it takes teachers valuing it and willing to take the creative risk themselves to make that happen. I think a lot of teachers believe in it but aren't necessarily going to do that because it feels scary and it feels different. And then I think there's a second piece that's important that I never want to deny, and that's the policy piece. Like we have to define success different in a different way than a standardized test. Like we have to do better than that. And I think that's a big piece of what gets in the way too. We're ultimately going to value what we assess, and we're going to, and right now what we assess is, standardized test results. And so, things like lifelong learning or creativity or student choice or personalization or any of those things, differentiation, all of those things will just be buzzwords until kind of the policies change. And that's the hard work. I mean, that's the complicated side because policy changes are hard to pull off. But I think that piece has to change too.
Well, John, this has been a fantastic conversation. I want everyone to know to go ahead and look up Launch and Empower. Well, I know that they're available on Amazon, but are they available on your website as well?
Yeah, you can get it. So if you check out my website at spencerauthor.com, you'll see that the books are there too.
Okay. And thank you for your time.
Well, thank you so much.
That is our show. We would like to thank speaker and author John Spencer for joining us on the Think Inclusive podcast. Make sure you check out his website, spenceauthor.com. and you can find him on Facebook and Twitter. Follow Think Inclusive on the web at thinkinclusive.us, as well as Twitter, Facebook, Google+, and Instagram. Today's show was produced by myself, talking into USB headphones, a Zoom H1 handy recorder, MacBook Pro, GarageBand, and a Skype account. You can also subscribe to the Think Inclusive podcast via Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or Podomatic.com, the largest community of independent podcasters on the planet. From Marietta, Georgia, please join us again on the Think Inclusive podcast. Thanks for your time and attention.
The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated Roland Garros in years. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to challenge their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.